Baroness Elora Finlay of Llandaff. For all interested in the assisted dying debate, Elora is well known as a steady and wise media presence questioning the relentless drive towards a change in the law. From an early age, Elora has been driven by a strong desire to make the world better. She wrote lots of letters as a wee girl to important people. And her desire for justice and to ensure that people who will not normally have a voice, has been a real passion. She told me of her dad's words to her a long time ago, and they've stuck with me. I think they've been kind of a script for her life. And her dad's advice to her was this: if you want to change the world, get to the top without losing your principles. It was passion and drive that took her from general practice to palliative care, because she saw the suffering of people dying at the end of life. It was that same drive that led to her becoming Professor of Palliative Care in Cardiff, Welsh Woman of the Year, and a life peer. Her position in relation to assisted dying owes much to her own clear moral compass, but has been forged through years of being with the dying and her compassion for people who are perhaps at this most vulnerable of times. This morning, we will hear from a peer of the realm, from an academic professor, maybe even from a media personality. But perhaps we need to listen most because of her life experience as a daughter of a mum who went through a long death process, a mum and a grandmum, and as an accompanist of the dying for many years. Ladies and gentlemen, will you welcome, please, Baroness Finlay.
Well, Max, thank you so much for an extremely generous and really humbling introduction. I hope I now don't disappoint people with my talk. I want to start off by quoting Cicely Saunders, who really was the founder of the modern hospice movement, and who said, "How people die remains in the memory of those who live on." I've been struck during the debates that there have been, both in the House of Lords and out in the public domain, how many people have had a bad experience of the death of somebody near to them. It might have been 10, 15, 20 years ago, but it's emblazoned on their memory and it influences their thinking and their view that no matter where the evidence is now, they're frightened that that could happen to them. And I think fear is quite a motivator behind much in this debate. But it also puts a huge onus on us who are encountering people who are dying to make sure that things are done well, and if they're not, to address them and to stand up and be the voice and say, no, that's good enough, not good enough. If we see bad care, we have to say, no, that's not good enough. If we witness it in hospital, in the community, in a nursing home, wherever, we have to say, I'm sorry, I'm prepared to have an argument with you. I might go head to head. This is not right. You're not meeting this person's needs, because for this person, it is their only chance to get it right. I'm going to cover this morning some of the issues around dignity, what it is and what it isn't. As I said already, stopping interventions. I want to look at where control is in clinical consultations. And then, of course, what happens in assisted suicide or euthanasia discussions. And finally, a little bit about the evidence around doctors' views. First of all, let's be clear about what we're talking about here. This euphemism, assisted dying, encompasses lots. But actually, it really worries me because we are assisting dying people all the time on their last journey in life. And as a midwife said, a specialist nurse said to our select committee some years ago, a midwife assists at birth. A specialist palliative care nurse assists when someone is dying, but they don't bring about their death. What we're talking about here is deliberately foreshortening life, either through euthanasia, which is where the doctor actually injects a lethal substance to bring about death, and I'll tell you how that's done, a little bit about that. Physician-assisted suicide, where the doctor prescribes the means, but doesn't actually do the giving. But where do you draw the line, and how much assistance to somebody who perhaps has weakness, who can't lift a glass to their lips? Where does assistance begin and end? And then assisted suicide, which is completely outside of clinical care, which is really what we see with people whose family assist them to go off to Switzerland at the moment to the Dignitas facility or something similar, or where they order things on the internet. But it is outside clinical care. Oh, gosh, I mustn't press quite so hard, must I? As I said, with physician-assisted suicide, you drink. Now, what do you take? You don't have more morphine. This isn't about drugs that we're normally using. You're talking about 9 or 10 grams of barbiturate, which is way outside any clinical prescription. You're giving a massive overdose to bring about death as fast as possible. It would make you vomit, and therefore you have to preload with an antiemetic, something to stop you vomiting. It tastes filthy. It's a tumbler full because it's not terribly soluble. But it's a fixed dose. This is not medication. This is a lethal drug. What do you use for euthanasia? Physician-administered euthanasia. You use a short-acting barbiturate injected into a vein to render somebody unconscious. And then usually in Holland, they follow it up with pancuronium, which completely paralyzes somebody. So even if they regain consciousness, you couldn't tell because they're completely paralyzed. They die of asphyxia because they stop breathing. Now, that is what's used in the US for executions. And there was a study of executed prisoners in the US that found that the blood levels of the anaesthetic agent had fallen so that, to the level that probably about 80% of them regained consciousness before they died, but because they were completely paralysed, they looked as if they were peaceful because they were completely locked in, asphyxiating in a body because they couldn't breathe. There are complications as well with both of these. I've already told you some of them. After attempts at physician-assisted suicide, a few people have woken up again. I think there have been 3 in Oregon. People don't necessarily die quickly. The time from taking the lethal drugs until death, the maximum has been 102 hours. That's quite a long time. The average is 26 minutes, I think. What I find interesting is some people have died very quickly, too quickly for them to have absorbed the drug. So I do wonder whether it's almost the permission giving of they're now taking this and signalling the end of their life and then that they've died. And we know when families sometimes say to a patient, it's okay, you can let go. People just die because they're dying of their disease. And with physician-administered euthanasia, there are descriptions of people having convulsions and so on, twitches, different episodes. It was Cicely who said, you matter because you are you, and you matter to the last moment of your life. We will do all we can, not only to help you die peacefully, but also help you live until you die. And that has really been the essence of what we've been trying to do with palliative care, to restore people to being able to do whatever it is that they can still do and have meaning in their lives. I'm not doing this very well, am I? That's it. So we try to reset people's hopes and aspirations to be more realistic, but we also try to improve reality. Let me give you a concrete example of that. I had a patient who was desperate to die on his home soil in Africa. Terribly, terribly sick. I'm not a travel agent, but we managed to persuade an airline, against all odds, to take him. And amazingly, during the weeks running up to him going, he stayed alive. None of us could understand how he stayed alive. But not only that, but he was very creative in that time. We gave him lots of drugs and lots of analgesics. And he got on the plane and he got off the plane. And he died the following day. Because that was what he had to achieve in life. So we were narrowing that deficit in his quality of life for him to achieve his last wish. But sometimes people need to rearrange perhaps a wedding of someone in the family or whatever. We need to help them reset their hopes that even though they probably won't be alive in a year's time, but who can tell? So why not hope for the best, but plan for the worst and reset their goals? To move it on, and I'll signal to you, that might be easier. Hello? Hi. Can I signal to you, because I keep on messing this up? And if I just signal with a raised finger, that's easier. Thank you. So Cicely, I think, had a really good phrase for what dignity is. It's about having a sense of personal worth. It's how you feel about yourself. You would all know if your dignity was taken away from you. Hello? You're going to have to watch me, I'm afraid. Oh, okay. I'll try again then with this. But it was Harvey Chochnov who showed that the way that care is delivered either enhances your sense of dignity or takes it away, undermines it. We all know of people who complain that their care undermined their dignity. So what about this business of stopping treatments that was already raised? Withdrawing treatments or withholding treatments that we don't think are doing any good? Well, we agonise over them as doctors. We worry about stopping, and we weigh up in the balance the benefits against the risks and the burdens of the intervention. We also weigh up issues around justice. Can you use all of the resources on one person? That's the argument over chemotherapy drug costs at the moment. These are real questions. But if we look at the individual, we agonise, and sometimes when we stop the intervention, the person dies quite quickly. For example, when we take somebody off a ventilator, they've been kept artificially alive by that ventilation, and the time has come and they say, enough. And we look after them in that period. We don't walk away. We look after them very intensively to make sure their symptoms are under control as they die of the underlying disease. But there are times when we agonise and we stop everything and people get dramatically better. And we discover that it was our treatment that was killing them before the disease, but we thought it was the disease. I'm afraid we're fallible. But most of the time, people actually seem to die whenever they probably would have died anyway. And we agonise over these decisions. And the course of a terminal illness isn't a straight line. It goes up and down and up and down. And in those dips, somebody might look as if they're dying. And I've had lots of patients where I've sat the family down and said, I really think you should stay the night. I really don't think they're going to be here in the morning. You know, that's my best guess, and so on. Next morning, the family have been on chairs all night, bleary-eyed. The patient's sitting up in bed, having breakfast. I've got one man who, it was at Christmas, and I said, you really must tell the children, because the children hadn't really been told how ill he was. And I said to the brother, I really don't think you should go on holiday to France for New Year, because your brother isn't going to survive. I'm pretty sure of that. We managed him as well as we could, got his very difficult symptoms under control, but he was dying, dying, dying. Next July, I'm walking down the hospital corridor. "Hello, Doc," he says. So we had a little joke about it. But it was great, actually. They'd had all that extra time. Unfortunately, his brother was really cross with me because he hadn't insured his holiday in France and I'd made him cancel it. But when you're talking about physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, you are giving a lethal dose of drugs expressly to end the patient's life, irrespective of how long it would have gone on for. Some of you may have seen that I wrote up about my own mum when she was dying. She was desperate for physician-assisted suicide, angry with me because I would not advocate changing the law. I was opposing Lord Joffrey's bill. It was very difficult. She was in a hospice. The hospice director said to me, "I think she's going to be dead within a few weeks, Laura. How are you going to cope? You're in the middle of opposing this legislation. You've got your mother angry that you're not letting her have a lethal overdose." 4 years later, at home, having had really good times, Mum had come to stay in my house, she'd been out, she used to go around the supermarket using the trolley like a walking frame, because it was really quite supportive, entertaining people at home, living completely independently. It was 4 years later that she died, not 4 weeks. And she, in that time, saw her great-grandson's born, and she never regretted that time. She said it was wonderful and rich and was glad that she had it. Now, what about the data from Oregon? Robert told you about the change, the subtle change that happens in society. And I think this data shows it, really. Because if you look at the blue lines there, the blue columns, that's the number of prescriptions issued. And the green are the number of deaths that have occurred with people taking the lethal drugs that were prescribed. And there's been a steady rise. Now, the candidates say, oh, the candidates for this bill, the people proposing this bill say, oh, it's fine. Look, it's levelled off and there's been a dip. But of course, that was deaths and there were more prescriptions issued. And we don't know how many more deaths are going to come along behind. I think actually that shows it's pretty good data. Because in any kind of scientific data, you expect there to be a fluctuation. But there's no doubt at all that that line is an upward slope. It's a 4.5 to 5-fold increase since they changed their law. And in those with motor neurone disease, which is a group that people worry about here, just over 7% of theirs were patients with motor neurone disease. So not huge numbers. But let me talk about that in a little bit of detail and tell you about a patient I had. A woman who was on ventilation, fully dependent for all her care, wanted lethal drugs to end her life. She and her husband were furious that we were not giving them to her and supporting her. Very, very angry. Why are you not doing this? She was compos mentis. She had capacity. And I'm going to come back to her. So hang on to her. And she was quite young. Why do people ask to end their lives? Well, they're frightened that tomorrow will be worse than today. Those memories of what they've seen before. They're frightened of pain. As Robert pointed out, of course, we're much better at pain control than we were. Those advocating the bill like to parade stories of where pain hasn't come under control. But actually, where you begin to look at those stories, they're often people with chronic pain syndromes rather than people who've got pain at the end of their life. All their people at the end of their life who've had sudden pain from perhaps a fracture or something that's happened as a sudden incident, when sadly, I'm afraid, the episode happens before you can give them the analgesia. And they may indeed have had a fracture, but it will be a sudden emergency episode of pain which people then have to get on top of. And they're frightened of losing control and frightened of losing their dignity. Frightened of being a burden. That's a big issue in today's society. People don't want to be a burden on family and friends. If you're going to take a decision, though, what do you need to take a decision? Any decision. You need accurate information. You need to have mental capacity to take the decision, not be confused, you know, not be profoundly depressed or whatever. And it has to be voluntary, not under pressure from anybody, not under pressure from the family who actually are really worried about the fixed-term life insurance running out. I was taken in by one such family and really believed that they were loving and caring. Their worry about their mum's analgesia disappeared when her birthday happened and she was still alive. And they realised they'd lost £11,000. They didn't come and ask about it anymore. We were taken in. We thought they were loving and caring. But those subtle pressures, the pressures about the cost of care, the cost of heating, the cost of nursing home fees and so on, those are all subtle. They're not somebody directly pushing you into it. So what about information for a start? Well, in the select committee, we heard from the pathologist that actually one in 20 of diagnoses are found to have been wrong when you do a post-mortem. So I'm afraid we're not very good and accurate. There is a phenomenon in medicine called diagnostic labelling. It's very easy when someone's got a diagnosis attached to them, such as cancer, to attribute everything that's happening to the cancer and to miss the fact that they might have an infection or something, high calcium levels, that they look as if they're dying, but actually they're fully reversible. What about prognosis? All the evidence is, as was said to us, that medicine is a probabilistic art. If you look at, can you predict survival? You can say somebody is likely to be alive in a year's time. I hope that applies to all of you in this room. You can look at somebody and say they are probably, I wouldn't be surprised if they were dead in a month. But at 6 months, you can only toss a coin on it. You honestly cannot tell. There's no accuracy. And even when we think someone's in the last 48 hours of life, we find that actually 3% of them improve. So we're wrong, just like my man who met me in the corridor. And what about mental capacity? Well, as Matthew Hotoff said, written down in law, it looks simple. It sounds like something objective, but it's really difficult to measure. And actually, in patients with motor neurone disease, nearly a third of them are actually cognitively impaired. That means their thinking's distorted by the changes that have happened in the brain. And interestingly, in Oregon, there was a good study following people who had passed all their tests, the so-called safeguards, to get the lethal drugs. One in six of them were found to have an undiagnosed, untreated clinical depression. Not just depression, as you might use the word, but a full-blown clinical depression. But the other thing that was interesting is that all of the patients with depression were in the group that went ahead and took the drugs to end their lives. So their lack of diagnosis may well have skewed them into actually going down the route of physician-assisted suicide rather than physician prescription of lethal drugs, which they then didn't take and died of their disease. And what about voluntariness? I said a bit about it already. Internal pressures, fear of being a burden, knowing what your care costs, or external. But the other thing that's important is a fluctuating desire for death. And my mum exhibited it by the bucketful. Sometimes she would say, oh, my life's not worth living. I don't want to carry on. And other times she would see that life was really worth living. I have an uncle who's 98. Who occasionally has the talk with me about, I really think that I'm going to die in the next week or two and my time has come. And the last time he did this, I said, look, you can't die now. I'm too busy. I can't cope with it. Oh, he said. I said, look, I need you. I need you to listen to all the young women in the family who are having emotional problems and they'll come and talk to you. And you're sitting here all the time, so you're always listening. And I'm afraid I am too busy to spend 2 hours listening to them going round in circles. Oh, my dear, he said, am I of some use? Shall we have a cup of tea? So we stopped talking about dying and we had a cup of tea. He needed to feel that he was of use, that he was of personal worth. Compassion, a really difficult one. There's compassion on both sides of the debate. Nobody's saying that people don't have compassion. But I'm afraid, whilst most parents love their children, not all children love their parents. And what about the influence of the doctor and on the doctor? The pressure to clear beds, the doctor who's exhausted, perhaps the doctor who just doesn't really like that person who's the patient, but is being very professional. And the pressure to save costs in an NHS, which is really struggling. But the other thing that Robert touched on, and I think is really important, is normalisation in society. So it becomes an expectation that if you've got advanced disease, this is the way you'll go. And what about Our Lady with motor neurone disease? Well, it was a Saturday morning. I persuaded her husband to go to the pub. And actually, in all honesty, he was really grinding me and the nurses into the ground. He didn't want to go, and she was frightened of being left on her own. So we drew up a rota, and I said, I'll take the first half hour in the rota. And the nurses and came after me. And I sat with her and asked her what was really upsetting her the most about her current situation. And I expected her actually to throw back at me that I wasn't giving her lethal drugs and thought we would explore that. And she said to me with her speech aid, which was so it was a slow conversation, it was the whiskers on her chin. And I looked and she had really long whiskers that had come on her chin, and of course she hadn't been able to pluck them. So I said to her, shall I give you a quick facial? Well, I wasn't trained in how to do facials, I'm not a beautician, but we found some forceps and the nurse came in with me and helped me, and we plucked out these really long hairs, and the nurse sensibly said, would you like us to make you up? And she said yes, so we emptied our handbags at the nurse's station and were able to find a selection of eyeshadows and a bit of mascara and a bit of blusher and went in and gave her a choice. And her response was, I feel like a woman again. And from that day on, she never asked for a life to be ended, but every night she asked for the makeup to be taken off and every morning she asked to be made up again. And she died a few weeks later, looking lovely. And she did have another facial as well. So think about the doctor in a consultation. I've put a woman on the front of this tandem. How many of you ride a tandem? Oh, nobody in the room. Okay. Well, I can tell you, my husband puts me on the back seat of the tandem. It's about control. Whoever's got the handlebars has the control. And you steer down whichever road you're going to go. And the reality is that doctors have control because we have knowledge, and knowledge brings power. And the way that you steer that consultation when somebody says, so you really want to die, is I hope wherever you are in the world, you listen and listen to what's going on. But in those jurisdictions where the law has changed, and I've sat in and observed consultations, what you find is that very quickly you go down the road of processing the request. And in processing the request, you give a subliminal message that you are right to think that you'd be better off dead. In the situation where I have to go back, I'm forced to go back and ask, what's making today so terrible? And what can I do to improve today? I'm also giving a subliminal message that you are worth me working hard to improve things. And they're very, very different messages. Now, what drives the desire for death? Well, there's good research evidence behind it. One of them is feeling a burden. The other is feeling depressed and hopeless. And those are mutually reinforcing independent factors. So if you're already depressed and you're faced with a doctor who's giving you hopeless messages, then that will compound the whole thing. And major depression in itself. And I've already told you about Gansini's research in Oregon. And what are the motivations of doctors and nurses to practice voluntary euthanasia? Which is one step on from physician-assisted suicide, but this is the research work, that's where it was done.
seems to be associated with psychological variables within that healthcare professional themselves, often their past behaviour. Once we've done something once, it becomes easier to do it again. I was struck by a very senior person from the armed forces who said, the first time that you kill somebody, it's terrible. The second time, it's easier. Lord McColl, who was on our select committee, was told by a doctor, the first time I performed euthanasia was very difficult. The next time it was easier, and after that it was a piece of cake. It gets easier, everything we do. When I did paediatrics, the first time I put a needle in a child's vein, I felt awful about it. Within a few weeks, I was zipping cannula in. The children screamed as much, but I wasn't affected by it. I'd become inured to it. I got used to it. And the other thing is the patient's life expectancy. But make no mistake about it, even though doctors pretend that they know, they haven't a clue. Doctors in the UK are, by and large, opposed to physician-assisted suicide. And that's at complete variance with all these polls that we hear about. Although actually in the polls, when people have explanations that the doctors are opposed, that things can go wrong and so on, the numbers split right down to 43% in favour and 43% against and worried about changing the law. The GPs, College of GPs, did a very good consultation. They came back with 77% of respondents opposed to the law. Hospital physicians, again, the RCP, Royal College of Physicians, has finished a very good consultation of its members. Again, a high opposition, but interestingly, nearly 70% of all physicians across all disciplines, this was, with a high response rate, did not want to be involved. In that group, nearly 19% were prepared to be involved. But when you look at the discipline of Max and I, we are the people that are looking after dying patients day in, day out. Last week, the results came back from the palliative medicine survey that showed only 4% are prepared to be actively involved. And why? Because I think we're just aware of how complex and dangerous it could be. And what about the so-called safeguards? Well, Robert's run through them as well. I want to address them from a medical perspective for a moment. Is somebody terminally ill? Well, I'm afraid that there is no clear way of determining. And you could shoehorn people into that category, particularly people with heart failure, advanced chronic disease, and so on. People who've had a massive stroke, you could say, I wouldn't be surprised if they'd be dead in 6 months' time, because no, you wouldn't be surprised if they had another stroke. How many of you have looked at a group of people, seen a couple and thought, well, I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't make it till Christmas? How many of you and your families have got the family member where we've all said, well, we'd better make it a nice Christmas because it's probably their last? And the next Christmas, we'd better make it a nice Christmas because this one's probably their last. Cancer is actually the easiest of them to predict the course of the disease, but even there, we're hopelessly wrong. What about a clear and settled wish? How long do you have to have the wish for? What is a clear and settled wish? And above all, how do you assess it in law? Because people can feel coerced and fluctuating. What about mental capacity? Well, the bigger the decision you have to make, the greater the capacity you need. We've all seen that with patients with dementia. They can choose the clothes they want to wear. They know whether they want to have scrambled eggs or bacon and sausage for breakfast. They'll choose that, and rightly they should have the choice, but you wouldn't let them go to the bank and start sorting out their financial affairs because you know that they just couldn't cope and they wouldn't even remember why they were there or what they'd done. Being informed of options isn't the same as experiencing them. The legislation that we're considering talks about being offered palliative care, but you don't know what it's like. Max and I have loads and loads of patients who say, I never believed you would really get on top of my symptoms. I never believed I could feel this well again. I never believed I could feel whole again as a person. And the business of two doctors. Well, I'm afraid that the reality is that if you're inclined towards something and you're going to suggest a second opinion doctor, you will not choose somebody who's going to disagree with you. That's the nature of a second opinion doctor. You suggest the name of somebody who's going to agree with you because you don't want somebody to come along and say, well, I think they're completely wrong about A, B, and C. So that's human nature. And there's also a little danger in there, actually, that Dr. A thinks, well, the final decision will be taken by Dr. B, and Dr. B thinks, well, actually, Dr. A's done all the decision-making. I'm just rubber-stamping it. I'm sure he's gone into it properly. Look at Dr. Shipman's cremation forms, all countersigned by a so-called independent doctor. Some of them had their doubts, but suppressed their doubts because, well, he was a nice man. We all know him. We see him at the local medical meetings, blah, blah. There's no safeguard in there. And the business of the final act being initiated by a person is probably safer because it's more of an active role than putting your arm out for a doctor to inject you. But at what point do you say, help, no help? What about the person who's already being fed through a gastrostomy? Do you put it in the device? Do you set it up? Somebody who isn't swallowing, do you put it in a drip? What do you do? Where's the line? And even Charlie Faulkner, Lord Faulkner, whose bills before Parliament on the Today programme agreed that it cannot be watertight. There will be mistakes. And of course, the current bill has really no proper monitoring process in it and no proper reporting in it. It's got a fudge towards it, but it's not really there. I just want you to think, though, too, a little bit beyond the patient now for a moment, of beyond the person who might be asking and who may be suffering and feel that they have no purpose in life and their life is terrible. What about others around them? What's the effect on children? We just don't know. But I was very struck when I came across a young man whose mum had gone to Dignitas and who then found it very difficult as he entered his 20s to form relationships because he felt that he wasn't capable of loving properly because his love hadn't been enough to keep his mum going and she felt that she needed to end her life. And I've been struck when I've had patients, some with horrible, horrible fungating tumours of the face and parts of the body. The children look beyond that. They look beyond to the person that they love. You know, the children who go in to see Gran, and they're not worried that there's bits of dinner down her pullover, because it's Gran and they still love her. And the younger children in particular see past all of the superficial appearances to the real person, the essence inside. And there hasn't been any good study. There's been study of adult bereaved talking about there isn't any great difference in severe poor bereavement, but actually when you look at those who have really severe reactions, it does seem as if the group that had euthanasia, if there's been conflict in the family, then some of them have a really difficult time in bereavement. So it isn't the answer either for the next generation. This was a drawing done by a child whose parent had died with us in the hospice. And I put it up because I just want to remind you about the impact on children. They are ostracised by other kids at school. They feel left out. They feel that something's happened to them and they feel guilty. They feel as if somehow they've played a role in the death of the person that they love. And we've all seen children, however difficult and chaotic their parents are, they still love them because that's their parent, particularly small children. And just to quote my mum, 4 years after she'd wanted assisted suicide and was dying, she said, "I'm at the end of my life, in bed and unable to do, but able to receive and find an unexpected serenity in receiving. A week ago, I wanted to die, exhausted by an existence that seemed to become hollow and futile, fearful of disrupting lives of those I love so dearly. My wish to die resurfaced, yet my ability to live resurfaced too." And she died shortly after writing that. The way that people die lives on in the memory of those left behind. Our care and what we do is like the dandelion clock. And I really worry that we haven't looked adequately at the impact on medicine and the reasons that doctors, by and large, don't want to go down this road. And the more experienced they are at looking after dying patients, the less that they want to go down this road. Thank you.